Welcome to the Deco Retro program here on Planet FM. We will bring you interesting interviews, updates of future deco, modern, retro, and other related events. Also the stories that celebrate New Zealand's history and its people, as well as book reviews and other snippets capturing the glamour and fascination of a bygone era.
Deco Retro, Deco Retro.
Good afternoon, listeners. I'm Philippa. Today's program is about Catherine Mansfield and her relationships with family and friends, some of whom she portrayed in her stories in a different, not always flattering guise. A brilliant satirist, her writing was an all-consuming passion through which she often mocked the human traits and idiosyncrasies she despised or found amusing. An unusual child, Kathleen, or Cass as the family called her, was an astute observer of people and the world around her. The writer in her, instinctively storing those insightful observations for later use when her creative genius would be fully realised. The early photographs reveal a rather stolid, sullen child with a very penetrating gaze. Who was this difficult, moody girl who would later revolutionise the English short story? Kathleen Mansfield Beecham was born in Wellington on the 14th of October 1888, on a wild Wellington day. Great gusts of wind shook the Thorndon house, rattling the windows at No. 11 Tinacori Road. She was the third child born to Annie and Harold Beecham. Harold was a very successful businessman, so Kathleen and her siblings enjoyed a privileged childhood. She and her sisters attended Wellington Girls High. In 1903, Kathleen, Vera and Chaddy were sent to Queen's College, London, to finish their education, Kathleen taking violoncello lessons, reading extensively. She particularly admired Oscar Wilde, the divine Oscar, and writing for the school magazine. In December 1906, a reluctant Kathleen and her two sisters returned home to Wellington, a city Kathleen now found utterly boring and bourgeois. Discontented and restless, she was determined to return to London, where she could live life on her own terms, a life that suited her artistic temperament as an aspiring authoress. 2 years later, in 1908, her parents relented, allowing her to return to London alone, her father having agreed to give her a generous allowance. Free at last, Kathleen could now enjoy the intoxicating pleasure of being back in the city she loved and immerse herself in her art. 3 months later, she fell passionately in love with Arnold Trowell's twin brother, Garnet, a musician whom she wanted to marry. However, much to everyone's surprise, 6 months later in March 1909, having only known each other for 2 to 3 weeks, Kathleen married 31-year-old George Bowden. That same evening, leaving him to join Garnet, who was on tour. It was about this time that she fell pregnant with Garnet Trowell's child. Mrs. Beecham, meantime, hurried to London, arriving on the 17th of May to take matters in hand. She took Kathleen to stay in a village in Bavaria, departing a few days later for New Zealand, leaving Kathleen alone and friendless. Back in Wellington, Mrs. Beecham cut Kathleen out of her will. Sometime late in June, Kathleen suffered a miscarriage. January the following year, Catherine Mansfield, as she now called herself, returned to London, where she met John Middleton Murray, the editor of Rhythm magazine. 2 years later, in 1912, they began living together. In July 1913, Murray's magazine, Rhythm, failed, leaving them heavily in debt, and he was declared bankrupt in February 1914. In August that year, war broke out. Catherine's brother Chummy died in France in October 1915. She was devastated. That year, Catherine developed a terrible cough, her incipient tuberculosis now taking hold. The next few years saw the Murrays become friendly with D.H. Lawrence and his wife Frieda. They also joined Lady Otterline Morell's weekend house parties at Garsington, meeting the Bloomsbury set and many of the intelligentsia of that era. In February 1918, Catherine had her first lung hemorrhage. That year, 1918, TB killed 1,000 people a week in Britain, and in 4 years, it would also take Catherine's life. It was also the year the Murrays finally married. Sadly, over the next 4 years, Catherine's health steadily declined. She moved continuously between Europe and England in search of a cure. In September 1920, she rented Villa Isola Bella in Menton in the south of France, where she lived for 9 months, often desperately lonely. And in spite of her spiralling ill health, she continued to write with feverish intensity. In August 1922, Catherine made her will. Then, in October, she entered the Gurdjieff Institute at Fontainebleau, seeking physical and spiritual healing. Murray visited her there on the 9th of January 1923. That evening, overcome by excitement, Catherine ran up the stairs to her room, causing her to have a massive hemorrhage. She then collapsed and died, aged 34. When he saw her that day, Murray felt that she seemed, quote, a being transfigured by love, absolutely secure in love. Famous for changing the art of the short story in English, Catherine Mansfield gained an enduring place in English literature. Virginia Woolf wrote in her diary, "Catherine's writing was the only writing I have ever been jealous of." Since 1920, KM has never been out of print. She is one of New Zealand's greatest literary icons. Today I'm visiting Cherry Hankin at her home in Auckland. Cherry has a PhD in English literature from the University of California at Berkeley. Her doctoral dissertation was a psychological study of Catherine Mansfield and her stories. Cherry lectured in English literature, specializing in New Zealand literature and 20th century British fiction at the University of Canterbury. She attained the rank of reader or associate professor in English. Cherry, thank you for inviting me to your home today. I started by asking Cherry if there was anything in Catherine's childhood that foreshadowed the kind of writer she became.
Well, like all of us, she was greatly influenced by her childhood, and what happened to her in those early years continued with her through her life and certainly shows through in her writing. I find her a very complex character, one who really had two sides to her personality. As a young girl, she once wrote a jotting about these two sides. She said there was a very sweet little girl that everybody loved, nice and chubby and conventional, but there was also a nasty, thin, unconventional little girl who they were very glad to get rid of when she died. So she was always aware of the fact that there were really two Catherine Mansfields, that there were two sides to her being.
Cherry then went on to explain to me Catherine's relationships with her family.
Well, she felt rather the odd one out in the family. There were two older sisters and then two younger siblings, and she felt herself very much of a loner. Really, to quite an extent, she felt that she was sort of unloved, if not unwanted, by her parents. She wrote a very early little story about herself in which she called herself Juliet. And in that she said that her childhood was a lonely one, that her only confidant was a dream face. And I'm quoting her. She said, Juliet was the odd man out in the family, the ugly duckling. She had lived in a world of her own, created her own people, read anything and everything which came to hand, possessed a violent temper, completely lacked placidity. So that was really the beginning of Catherine Mansfield putting herself into writing. But as I see it, from an early age, she retreated into a world of fantasy, even into a world of dream.
She told me about other childhood friendships that had influenced Catherine's life.
She had crushes, I suppose you could call it, on various women in her life. There was a Maori girl, Marta, and in New Zealand there was another very close friend called EKB, where she had something that was very like a lesbian experience. When she went to England, to Queen's College in London, there was her cousin Sylvia Payne, who she was very fond of and wrote very adoring letters to and complained that Sylvia didn't love her enough. So I think there was always a tendency to find comfort and solace and love from other women. And that, of course, included her great friend Ida Baker, who she also met at Queen's College and gave the name LM to.
When Kathleen, as she was then, went to Queen's College, she was studying the cello, so I think she thought of being a musician. But when did she finally decide she was going to become a writer?
Well, when she was brought home from Queen's College to Wellington, her father told her that there was no future for her as a cellist, and so she decided that she wanted to be famous. There was a French writer, Marie Bashkirtseff, who wrote in her journal about how she wanted to be famous, and Kathleen also said the same thing. But there's an interesting piece that she wrote about this time. She wrote to her friend Sylvia Payne from New Zealand, quote, "I am so keen upon all women having a definite future. Are not you? The idea of sitting still and waiting for a husband is absolutely revolting, and it really is the attitude of many girls. Would you not like to try all sorts of lives? One is so very small, but that is the satisfaction of writing. One can impersonate so many people."
Many of Catherine's ideas with regard to women's place in society were far ahead of her time. I suggested that Catherine was a feminist, even though she didn't think of herself as one. Cherry agreed, and she explained this side of Catherine's character.
Yes, she was. Yes, she wrote another time to herself. She says, "It is the hopelessly insipid doctrine that love is the only thing in the world, taught, hammered into women from generation to generation, which hampers us so cruelly. We must get rid of that bogey, and then comes the opportunity of happiness and freedom." So you can see that from a very early stage, Kathleen had set her heart on not only becoming famous, but on being the mistress of her own destiny. In other words, she really wanted control over her own life.
It's, in a way, she was really born in the wrong age. If she'd even been born a little later, and perhaps been younger in the 1920s, it would have been quite different for her. Attitudes had changed considerably. She was a daughter of the Victorian age, and that was her misfortune in a way.
Yes, it was. Well, she still desperately needed love, though. She didn't want to marry, and yet she needed love and she needed support. So when she met John Middleton Murray, he seemed to her the ideal person because he was an editor. He was well educated. But he also allowed her to dominate him. And later on, she said about him, "When we first met, it was I who kept him, and afterwards we'd always acted more or less like men friends." In other words, Catherine could take a more masculine role, while Murray took a more submissive role. And her first husband, George Bowden, also commented on this somewhat masculine streak in her, and he later wrote, quote, "She had an extreme and almost masculine sense of independence. And before they married, she enjoyed being a bachelor along with us." And this, for George Bowden, was part of her attraction for him.
I mentioned Catherine's friend, Ida Baker, and that though Catherine needed her, she also found Ida intensely irritating, almost loathsome at times.
Well, Ida adored Catherine, and she was always hanging around on the outskirts of her life, but it probably wasn't until Catherine became seriously ill that Ida became far more prominent. On the other hand, Catherine was very good at role-playing, and she had these two sides to her personality, and it suited her very well from time to time to play off Ida Baker against poor John Middleton Murray. And this role-playing was something she habitually indulged in and carried on really well into her life. Interestingly, she was apparently very good at play acting and very good at impersonation. And some friends that knew her said that mimicry was her strong suit and that her sense of drama was faultless, that she could think herself into any part. So she could actually change from being very loving with Murray to being very loving with Ida Baker.
Yes, Ida Baker, I know at Queen's College, the other girls, and a lot of people thought of her rather scornfully as being a bit of a doormat. But really, Ida wasn't quite what she seemed either. I think she was very, underneath it all, possessive, in a sense, of her relationship with Catherine Mansfield.
Yes, yes. Ida demanded too much from her. She demanded too much in terms of love and affection and constant attention. But at the same time, Catherine demanded a lot from Ida, including financial help from Ida from time to time. But Catherine finally repaid Ida by putting her into one of her very best stories, which is called Daughters of the Late Colonel. And that is the most sympathetic portrayal of an elderly spinster you could possibly find. Well, apparently there was a time in Ida's life when she had the opportunity of marrying, but Catherine made plain her continuing dependence on her, so Ida rejected this man and stayed with Catherine. Catherine wrote about this in a story called The Lady's Maid, in which she has a lady's maid who also forgoes marriage to stay with her employer who needs her. But in this story, she has Ida and Con. Sorry, she has. Con and Josephine, who have been so dominated by their father, so much at his beck and call, that when he finally dies, they no longer have the ability to make any decisions on their own. They can't decide what to do with the rest of their lives, and they're essentially shadows of what they might have been. And it ends up really being a very sad story, but a very understanding one.
Probably typical Victorian spinsters of that time. Now, perhaps we'd better move on to the Garsington set. Lady Ottoline Morell's weekend parties when the Bloomsbury crowd and, I suppose, most of the intelligentsia of that era turned up. They were a funny crowd. A lot of them weren't actually very nice, from what I read. So what can you tell us about them?
Well, Murray and Catherine were, I think, really very pleased to be included amongst the Garsington set and to be invited to the house parties there. And Ottoline was a very powerful and strong personality. And they, both of them, in different letters to Ottoline, expressed their continuing love and admiration for her. But when Catherine found out that, that Murray thought Ottoline was in love with him, she was extremely jealous and very upset. And Ottoline wrote that here was this woman just as bad and treacherous as anyone else who tried to steal Murray from her. So there was actually a bit of a falling out, really, with Garsington over this. Catherine needed to feel that she owned the person she loved, and she was actually a very jealous woman, and she was jealous of Ottoline for apparently usurping Murray's affections, but she was also jealous of Ottoline's friendship with other people. And if I can quote from Ottoline, Bertrand Russell said that when Catherine spoke about people, she was envious, dark, and full of alarming penetration and discovering what they least wished known and whatever was bad in their characteristics. She hated Ottoline because Murray did not. And I should say that Catherine certainly had a fling with Bertrand Russell on the side. That's how he knew that.
Cherry, how did Catherine write the Garsington set into her stories?
Well, Catherine writes the Garsington set into two of her stories. One of them was Bliss, and she portrays this frightfully trendy, arty set that are coming to dinner in really a very sarcastic way. There were the Norman Knights. He was about to start a theatre. She was awfully keen on interior decoration, and the young man, Eddie Warren, had just published a little book of poems. Probably that was modelled on T.S. Eliot. And then she had this beautiful Miss Fulton, who Bertha really is very strongly attracted to, only to find at the very end that her husband, in fact, is making an assignation with her. And that probably is based on Catherine's feelings about Ottoline and Murray. But the other story that she brings the Garsington set into is Marriage à la Mode. And in this one, she has all the arty crowd going to Garsington at the weekend, or going to the house at the weekend, with a husband that was really Philip Morell, being completely ignored by his wife, who just wants to dance around and have fun with all the arty set. So that really is a very telling story, that one.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Garsington set were a pretty promiscuous lot, really. And let's face it, Catherine did have a few affairs herself, including with the French writer Francis Carco. But I think we're about to run out of time now. So thank you so much, Cherry. I've enjoyed talking to you and hearing all about the psychological aspect of Catherine Mansfield.
My thanks go to Cherry Hankin for agreeing to share her specialist knowledge with us, giving us a fascinating insight into Catherine Mansfield's life and stories from a psychological perspective. I very much enjoyed meeting Cherry to record this program. I hope you've all enjoyed it too.
Retro, future events.
Just as a matter of interest, May Beecham was a cousin of Catherine Mansfield. She was also the best-selling author of Elizabeth and Her German Garden. She made a romantic marriage to Count Henning von Arnim and went to live on his estate in Pomerania. She wrote several books about life in Germany. The Stables Theatre is presenting a play based on her story from the 7th to the 16th of November. For more information, phone 09 525 3336 or book at iticket.co.nz, phone 09 361 1000. If you enjoyed our program today, listen every second Wednesday of the month at 2:10 p.m. or download us anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/DecoRetro. And we would like to thank our sponsors, Club Moderne, Art Deco Society Auckland. We will keep you informed of all future exciting and glamorous events to be held by Club Moderne. For more information, email judith.moore650@gmail.com. That's judith.moore650@gmail.com. Bye for now.